After 5 days, he collapsed in what he described as a near-death experience, and he was revived. During that time, we saw massive protests inside the conference. We saw the White House, the French president, the German chancellor, then British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, all publicly called for Alaa's release. He wasn't released, but what he did accomplish with his own hunger strike was his transfer outside of the maximum security two-wing of Tora prison, which is known as Scorpion prison. He had been held there for over three years, with no books or reading material, no sunlight or fresh air, no exercise or time outside of his cell, no bedding, no pen and paper, no clock. And Alaa is very tough. He has a very strong intellect and will, but this was beginning to break him. And at some point a few months earlier, he had expressed suicidal thoughts. So they transferred him to this newly built prison in Wadi Natroun. But then he was supposed to be released last year in September, at the end of September. And the Egyptian government, in violation of Egypt's own penal code, did not count the 2 years of pretrial detention that he had spent in his sentence and said that he was going to continue until January 2027. And at this point, Leyla Swift decided that that was not going to happen. And so she embarked on this hunger strike, and she conducted most of it in London. She would spend most mornings outside the headquarters of the Foreign Office in London in this protest. By February of this year, she had lost a third of her body weight, and she collapsed, or her blood sugar levels collapsed, and she was hospitalized. And this prompted, just a few days later, the British Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, to have a call with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. And then we saw a flurry of diplomatic movement with Britain's National Security Advisor, Jonathan Powell, who helped broker the Good Friday Agreement in Northern Ireland, begin these talks. And this eventually culminated in July. Alaa was removed from the terrorism list, and eventually, he was pardoned. So, I think we also, just one final thing, we have to say that Alaa is free, but he doesn't have justice. He's spent more than half his adult life behind bars. His father died while he was in prison, and while Sanaa was in prison as well.
His father died while he himself, the father, was in prison? Alaa was in prison?
The father died while Alaa was in prison and Sanaa was in prison in 2014. Alaa's son Khaled, who's now 13, has grown up without him. And beyond Alaa, there's still so many thousands of political prisoners in Egypt, including dozens who are behind bars simply for speaking out in solidarity with Palestine and against Israel's genocide in Gaza. And Palestine is central to Alaa's politics and his thinking, and he was able to visit Gaza many years ago. He has a beautiful essay in the anthology of his writings called Palestine on My Mind that I encourage everyone to read. But yes, Alaa is free, and the photos and footage of him in Cairo with his family are joyous beyond comprehension. He spent last night in his bed for the first time in 11 years, and the world has been made that much richer with him finally back among us.
Well, we thought we'd end this segment. Clearly an Alaa Day for so many around the world with Alaa's freedom. With Alaa, in his own words, going way back, we first interviewed Alaa Abdel Fattah on Democracy Now! In February of 2011, during our special coverage of the Tahrir uprising of the Arab Spring. And I've just been told that we do have someone on the phone right now, so we're going to go right to that person. Can you tell us who you are and where you are?
This is Alaa Abdel Fattah. I'm an activist in this revolution. I'm standing in front of the TV building in Cairo.
Okay, tell us, Alaa. It's great to have you with us, a prominent Egyptian blogger, democracy activist. What is happening in front of the presidential palace, one of a number of new places that are being occupied by protesters, like Egyptian state TV as well, and the parliament?
In front of the TV building, it's a big crowd. We can't shut down the TV building because of its shape, and it's heavily barricaded by the army. But what we're trying to do is put pressure on the employees working inside to join us, to revolt and refuse to spread state propaganda.
So that was Alaa Abdel Fattah in February of 2011. In December of that year, I interviewed him again after he spent nearly 2 months in prison, which prevented him from attending the birth of his son, Khaled. I asked Ale to describe his conditions in prison at the time.
The first 5 days, I was put in a pretty bad prison. Now, all prisons in the world are bad. Like, you know, losing your freedom is quite tough. But also, all prisons in Egypt are in very poor conditions. And so even if they don't torture you, just spending one night there is already, you know, a bit too much. But I was in a particularly bad prison, and they made sure to put me in a particularly bad cell and to deny me, you know, any comfort. So, for instance, I was in a complete darkness for 5 days.
So that's Egypt's most prominent political prisoner, Ala Abdel Fattah, in 2011. He has just been released from prison after well over a decade, 13 years, and reunited with his family. I want to thank our guest, Sharif Abdelkaddous, award-winning journalist, Middle East, North Africa editor at Dropsite News, and Adef Swif, Ala's aunt, and renowned author, speaking to us from London, the first family member he got to speak to yesterday after he was freed. Next up, California Governor Gavin Newsom signs the No Secret Police Act, banning all law enforcement, including ICE agents, from covering their faces while conducting raids. Stay with us.
What happened to the words for which we once stood? I will stand for you. Would you stand for me?
Everybody deserves to be free. By the Resistance Revival Chorus, performed at Town Hall on Sunday night for the Voices for Gaza program. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to California, where Governor Gavin Newsom has signed into law the No Secret Police Act, banning all law enforcement, including ICE agents, from covering their faces while conducting raids. The ban's a response to recent immigration raids in Los Angeles and other areas where ICE officials made mass arrests while heavily masked. This is Governor Newsom speaking before signing the legislation.
The impact of these policies all across this city, our state and nation, are terrifying. It's like a dystopian sci-fi movie. Unmarked cars, people in masks, people quite literally disappearing, no due process, no rights in a democracy where we have rights. Immigrants have rights, and we have the right to stand up and push back.
The new California law was quickly denounced by Trump administration officials, including Tricia McLaughlin, Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs at Homeland Security. She said, quote, a sanctuary politician is trying to outlaw officers wearing masks to protect themselves from being doxxed and targeted by known and suspected terrorist sympathizers, unquote. The acting U.S. attorney for the Central District of California, Bill Asaley, didn't just denounce the law, but said ICE agents should not follow it. This is U.S. Attorney Asaley during an interview with KCAL News.
We're not going to follow it. The law has no force or effect on federal agencies. The state of California has no jurisdiction to regulate anything that we do in the federal government, and I've instructed our agents to disregard it. So we will continue doing our operations as we have been doing them. The reason the officers wear face masks...
We're now joined by two guests. Ava Bitran is the Director of Immigrants' Rights at the ACLU of Southern California, joining us from Riverside, California. And in Harlem, we're joined by New York Congressmember Nydia Velazquez, who introduced the No Masks for ICE Act in Congress, which would bar agents nationally from wearing facial coverings during enforcement actions and require them to wear clothing displaying their name and affiliation with ICE. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Ava Bitron, let's begin with you in California. The significance of the No Secret Agents Act being signed into law, and yet Trump officials saying, do not follow the law to ICE agents. Talk about where this law came from.
This law came from the enormous siege of our immigrant people here in Southern California that we have seen the federal government, beginning in June, carry out all the way until now. What we saw were bands of masked, powerfully armed, and really swiftly moving federal agents kidnapping our community members. And that's what prompted California to react, to say, this is not how we handle our immigrant people. For us, it is important that due process prevail, that transparency prevail, and that we free our people from the kind of siege of kidnappers that's come out to Southern California.
But Eva, some people have criticized this law because it has loopholes, that it allows masks, exceptions for SWAT teams and undercover operations. How do you respond to those concerns?
My understanding is that what this law is trying to do is to take us back from the era of routine sort of masking based on completely foundationless officer claims of fear, and back to sort of the technical necessities that officers would claim in previous years or previous administrations. And the loopholes are designed to sort of protect for that.
I'd like to bring in a U.S. Congress member, Nydia Velazquez. Welcome back to Democracy Now! I wanted to ask you about the legislation that you've introduced. What are the specifics of the legislation and also your hopes, your expectations of whether it can pass or not?
Good morning, and thank you for having me, Amy and Juan. So as you can, as you see, the Trump administration is already saying that they are not going to comply with the law passed by California. And this is why we need to have a federal solution that will apply nationwide, and it will ban the use of masks, and it will require for any ICE agent to wear a uniform that clearly has their names and badge numbers so that there is transparency and accountability.
Ava Bitron, I just wanted to ask you, what does this mean? As Congressmember Velazquez tries to introduce a federal solution which would require these federal agents, on the ground, what is this now going to look like? First of all, it doesn't go into force, the No Secret Police Act, for until next year. Is that right? And how do you get ICE agents to comply if the No Mask Bill is not passed in Congress?
So that's right, that the bill does not go into effect until next year. But what we are really seeing is our communities coming out to demand an end altogether, masked or unmasked, to the lawless and unconstitutional raids that we have seen ICE carrying out here. We've seen people in the streets peacefully asking for ICE to leave our community neighbors alone. We've seen rapid response networks. We've seen community defense initiatives to keep people safe. And we know that's the path forward, whether or not legislation is in effect.
Yeah, and I'd like to go back to Representative Velazquez. The ICE data shows, for instance, in New York, that there's been nearly a six-fold increase in immigration detentions, going from 500 last year to almost 2,800 in the first 7 months of this year. What has been your experience, and as these ICE dragnets have spread across the country, and even in your state?
Well, people are terrorized. Families do not want to, parents do not want to go to bring their children to school, to take the subway, to even be appear before an immigration judge, because they know that they could be ambushed by ICE agent in those federal courts. people are terrorized. And this is the whole purpose of this mass deportation. It's just to terrorize, to instill fear. And my message to America is that we live in a country with laws. And everyone, every person, whether you are undocumented or not, you have a right to due process. And this is this use of police tactics of agents wearing masks, of ambushing people in the streets in front of school children, is undermining safety and security in our communities. And we have to have a federal response. This administration is out of control and is affecting everyone, not only undocumented, bystanders who sometimes when they witness on mass, not only mass agents, but on cars that are not identified, they think that a kidnap is taking place. But also, it incentivized criminals to wear masks so that they could commit crimes and assault immigrants in this country.
I wanted to ask you about Federal Plaza, 26 Federal Plaza, Congressmember Velasquez. A federal judge has granted a preliminary injunction to improve the conditions at this notorious ICE jail inside this federal building in Manhattan. Immigrants have described being imprisoned for days or weeks at a time in overcrowded cells without access to medication or proper sanitation, forced to sleep on the concrete floor, left hungry, without outside contact. In the last week, something like 11 of your fellow Democratic elected officials were arrested. Does ICE's use of masks, do you think, directly connect to the refusal to allow transparency in these facilities that now a federal judge is saying must be scrutinized? You just most recently, City Controller Brad Lander, who is campaigning around the city with Zoran Mandani, and public advocate Jumaane Williams were among those arrested. Lander was arrested again.
Yes. You know, I have attempted twice, with Jerry Nadler, Goldman, and Adriano Espaillat to enter 26 Federal Plaza. And every time they have not allowed us to go into the 10th floor, Adriano Espaillat and myself, we forced ourselves to get into the 10th floor, but not into the detention facility itself, because they prevented us. They keep lying. They're saying that there is not a detention facility, that is a processing center. Yet we have seen videos that shows how crowded they are, and it is, and the unsanitary conditions, the lack of meals, showers, and so on. So the judge instructed them to improve the conditions. But not only do they lie, they are in violation of the statute, because we are within our legal right as members of Congress to go there and inspect the conditions of those facilities. And time and again, they prevent us from exercising our oversight responsibility.
Yeah, I just have one more question
again,
for... I'm sorry. I just have one more question for Ava before we break. There have been, as the Congresswoman said, there's been numerous arrests, up to more than 80 arrests of people who have been trying to assist these migrants when they're being rounded up by ICE. What is the ACLU's recommendation to people who are trying to support immigrants in these crises?
Yeah, we are really thankful to community members, immigrant and otherwise, who are coming out to give real testimony and witness to what's happening here. We continue to recommend that community members, if it is safe to do so, show up and record with their phones the interactions that are happening around them, to really give witness and also to force some transparency on what have been incredibly secretive operations. We also know that it's important for people to have Know Your Rights information, and we've seen our community members, Rapid Response Network members, shouting out Know Your Rights information to people as they are being detained, which has also been really powerful. At the ACLU, we have litigation that's been defending the rights of protesters who have been outraged about what's happening to immigrant neighbors here in LA, as well as litigation both about the conditions at the short-term holding facilities and as well as at the sort of conduct of these unconstitutional operations. So we are watching, community is watching, our neighbors are looking out for one another. We know that what happens in LA becomes the blueprint for the rest of the country with these enforcement operations, and we're also trying to model how to mount a proper civil response.
Ava Bitron, I want to thank you for being with us, Director of Immigrant Rights at the ACLU of Southern California. And thank you to Congressmember Nydia Velazquez, who introduced the No Masks for ICE Act in Congress. We just mentioned Brad Lander and Zoran Mamdani. She has endorsed Zoran Mamdani. We're hoping to have the New York City mayoral candidate on Democracy Now! Tomorrow. Next, we go to Chicago, where ICE agents threw a Democratic congressional candidate to the ground. Back in 15 seconds.
Well, I woke up this morning with my mind set on freedom. Woke up this morning with my mind.
This morning with my mind stayed on freedom, the resistance revival chorus performing at Town Hall on Sunday for Voices for Gaza. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show in Chicago, where Juan is, as at least 10 people were arrested in protests outside an ICE facility Friday, with federal immigration agents firing pepper balls and using tear gas on the crowd. Democratic congressional candidate Kat Abugazele was thrown to the ground by ICE agents. People rallied outside the facility to protest the Trump administration's Operation Midway Blitz, which has led to the arrest of nearly 550 people in a sweeping crackdown on immigrants in the city. We are going to Chicago, where we're joined by Kat Abugazele, who is a progressive congressional candidate in Illinois' 9th District, which includes Chicago. Kat, welcome to Democracy Now! Describe what happened to you. We're going to show the video.
Yeah, so this is actually the third time that ICE has thrown me to the ground. I have been at this facility for the last 3 weeks every Friday morning, and I'll be back this Friday. I encourage anyone in Illinois to join me 7 to 9 a.m. at 1930 Beach Street, B-E-A-C-H. This was, as I said, the third time that ICE has done this to me. It is probably the most violent occasion of throwing me to the ground. But essentially, a car was about to run over a fellow protester. And so I went to check on that person. And that was all the justification an officer needed to pick me up and throw me to the ground, despite being half his size. And what I really want to stress here is that is what these officers are willing to do when there is press and cameras around. The reason we are protesting at this facility is because they are committing human rights abuses within the Broadview processing facility. It is a processing facility, so people are not supposed to be kept there for more than 12 hours at a time, but they are being kept for days or weeks without beds, without hot meals, without hygienic products. And if they are willing to do that to a congressional candidate on camera in front of press, imagine what they are willing to do to their detainees behind boarded up windows.
And Kat, you say you found two badges there. What did it say on the badges?
So I have no idea the people who have accosted me. I have no idea who they are. I have no idea who these men are. They've had masks and sunglasses and hats sometimes when the sun is still down. We have seen two badge numbers the entire 3 weeks that we have been here, 4 weeks if we include a vigil earlier in the summer. And they were just numbers. There was no name and there was no identifying law enforcement agency. I have no idea if these men are actually affiliated with ICE. For all I know, this could just be random men who said, I'm going to put on a mask and a costume I got from Spirit Halloween to make me feel like I'm in the army and go and rough up some protesters today. We have no idea who these people are.
And in terms of what you know about the conditions in the Broadview facility, could you talk about that?
Yes, this Broadview facility is horrific. We've gotten reporting about dozens of people being kept in one cell. And these are our neighbors. These are pregnant women and grandmothers sleeping on concrete floors. I have not been inside the facility. Elected officials that have tried to inspect it have not been allowed inside. But I can attest that 2 weeks ago when I saw prisoners being marched into a van, they were in the same clothes they were detained in. And we have no idea how long they had been in there. And they were in the same clothes they were detained in. The conditions at this facility are horrendous. They are committing crimes against humanity. And it is so important to remember that all of the treatment that we went through as protesters doesn't hold a candle to what these detainees are dealing with. I mean, ICE agents shot and killed a man two Fridays ago in the Chicago area. They are able to act with impunity. They are able to hurt whoever they want. Last Friday was the first time they had taken protesters inside the facility. And while the video of me being thrown to the ground has gone kind of viral, I want to talk about a few other things that happened that day because they haven't been covered as much. We had to play tug of war with a man's body to keep him from being abducted inside the facility. Right before we were tear gassed, ICE was carrying a van with a protester that had been detained inside of the van. We stood arm in arm. All of this is happening on Broadview public property, on public streets. They tried to ram the van through us. A man fell in front of the van and the van was going to drive over his head. And I helped him up before that happened, but they were totally willing to do that. They shot a man in the face with a pepper ball bullet. They tear gassed us as they were trying to drive a car through a crowd. And then after that, they threw a tear gas canister at the press area, very intentionally, after protesters were already dispersing, because, you know, we were coughing and trying to get tear gas out of our eyes.
Ghazaleh, you are running for Congress, congressional candidate in Illinois' 9th district, which includes Chicago. The election is in November of 26, the ultimate election. Why are you running for Congress?
I'm a researcher and journalist who covers the far right. I have spent my career de-radicalizing and educating people on far right narratives and misinformation. I have spent my career, just as my colleagues have, trying to get Democrats to put up a resistance to the far right, to understand that the old playbook is gone and that it's not coming back. And I don't feel like our leaders are doing that. And so I got sick of waiting around and I decided to run the type of campaign I think we should. And that is with unapologetic progressivism, anti-fascism, and using our resources to materially improve people's lives right now. So we do voter outreach, but our campaign office also doubles as a mutual aid hub. We don't ask for $500 a plate at an event. For our kickoff event, for instance, we ask people to bring a box of pads or tampons for Chicago's Period Collective. We are about mobilizing people on the ground right now and making politics as accessible as possible, while also not compromising on basic human rights.
And you're running for the seat to replace Jan Schakowsky, who's retiring. There are several other candidates running in that field right now. Why do you think that voters would be best choosing you as the candidate?
You know, Illinois does a lot of things right. And that's the reason they aren't dealing with, until very recently, people like Stephen Miller and Elon Musk on a daily basis. I have been. I am the only candidate in my race with a track record of fighting and winning against the far right. I am the most effective communicator in my race. And I am the only candidate in my race to have the majority of her money come from small dollar donations. We've raised over $1 million and our average donation is just $32. We have over 7,000 volunteers, and that's not because I'm some force. It's because people want progressive policies. They want common sense policies. They want a center that recenters voters. And that's what we deserve from our leaders.
Kat Abu Ghazaleh, I want to thank you for being with us, progressive congressional candidate in Illinois 9th District, which includes Chicago. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.
The Slate Family Foundation Legacy Program was created to support artists who have dedicated their lives to music and who now struggle to maintain mental wellness and an adequate standard of living. Loneliness and social isolation are key risk factors for mental health conditions later in life. This May, during Mental Health Awareness Month, the Unison Fund is asking you to support Canadian legacy artists and musicians. For more information on this lifeline of hope, visit unisonfund.ca.